Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of July. This hour, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Our guest is the author of a really fascinating book, The Second Amendment, a Biography. What is the history of the Second Amendment? What's the meaning of the amendment? The Second Amendment, biography, Michael Waldman says, there is no evidence in the drafting of the amendment that it was about individual gun ownership for self-protection or hunting. The focus was on militias and the individual right to fulfill the duty to serve in the militias. Michael decided to write this book after the horrendous shootings in Newtown, and it is really a fascinating history. It goes all the way back to revolutionary times through the early history of, it goes through the Civil War, the early history of the NRA, the 1977 purge of the NRA leadership, resulting in a shift in focus from hunting and gun safety. It looks at where we are now and how each generation makes its own Second Amendment. Americans view the Constitution and its provisions in light of our times. Michael is with us this hour, and Michael has a really interesting history himself. He's president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, which is a nonpartisan law and policy institute focusing on improving the systems of democracy and justice. He is a very prominent national public interest lawyer and expert on, now I can say the Second Amendment, add to his list, presidency, democracy, and also the Constitution. He was director of speech writing for Bill Clinton, President Clinton, from 95 to 99. Wrote nearly 2,000 speeches, including many State of the Union and two inaugural addresses. He is author of other books, My Fellow Americans, The Most Important Speeches of America's Presidents, from George Washington to Barack Obama, A Return to Common Sense, POTUS Speaks, and Who Robbed America? A Citizen's Guide to the SNL Scandal. I would think that we're going to get more than a few phone calls on this book and on this subject, so feel free to keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter at K Dunn Show. Those are all ways for you to reach us. Michael Waldman, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for this book. I just have been recommending it to so many people. It's really so well done and so much history. My goodness, you worked on this.
Well, it's a fascinating story.
Yes.
As you say, I started working on it in the wake of the Newtown shootings, when the country was once again debating guns and gun safety laws and what to do about it. And this was the very first time we'd had that debate with the Second Amendment really rhetorically, and maybe more than that, so much at the center of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't really realize it's a sort of a surprise to a lot of people that the Supreme Court of the United States never ruled that the Second Amendment recognized an individual right to gun ownership until 2008.
Isn't that something?
The first time.
Yeah,
that they actually ruled otherwise before. So I wanted to understand what happened and, you know, what it really meant and what it's meant. And it turns out, as you say, it's really meant different things to us as a country at different times. And it's not ever been the product of this kind of pristine constitutional text, but always the push and pull of, you know, advocacy and public debate and public argument.
Mm.
So it turned out to be an interesting little window on a lot of the country's history, too.
Yes, very, very interesting. Through the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War One and Two, the assassinations, it covers so much territory. I read this aloud at the beginning of the show, and it is kind of a convoluted amendment, isn't it? You, at one point, you were saying, you know, you'd like to be able to tap James Madison on the shoulder and say, James, what exactly were you thinking?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you didn't even include all the commas.
Exactly, which, I was going to, right.
Frustrate people endlessly. You know, the framers believed in freedom to punctuate. a lot of the rules of punctuation were kind of loose at that point and not solidified into conventions until later, and so that makes things more complicated. And part of the reason that the Second Amendment wasn't seen the way we see it now is in a way that it was ignored in a lot of respects by lawyers and judges is because it is confusing or self-contradictory. When you go back and look at the founding era, when you look at what they thought they were doing, there's emphatically the fog of history. It's hard to figure out entirely what it is they mean. We can't really pretend, as some do, that we know everything, but we can know a lot. And it turns out that to the framers, they cared a great deal about those militias.
Right.
That first part, yeah. The well-regulated militia, that was not throat-clearing to them. It was very important to them. It was something they almost obsessed over. But the militias were very different from anything we know now. Every adult man, eventually every adult white man, was in the militia from age 16 to 60. And they were required by law to own a gun and bring it from home for the militia service. And this was, you know, there were no police departments. This was how they kept the peace. It was the military force. It was also even at the center of the political philosophy because they thought that above all else, the militias were a bulwark against tyranny, against what they were really afraid of, which was a standing army, as it was called, the kind of professional paid troops that were like King George's army, and that they thought could be kind of a proto-fascist force. And so, you know, when those the shot heard around the world happened and you had the Battle of Lexington and Concord, those were the well-regulated militias of citizen soldiers, and they were facing off against what they regarded as the worst and scariest thing there was, which was an army. And that was really very important to them as they fought the revolution and really was undergirded a lot of what their thinking was that led to the Second Amendment.
So tell me about Shay's Rebellion and why that's included in the book and how it it amplifies or gives us an understanding of this concern between militias and a national army and what might happen with militias.
Well, it's a great question, and it comes up now in part because a lot of the people who talk about militias now are unorganized. And somebody, if you think of somebody like the rancher Cliven Bundy out west waving his gun around and saying that he's like the founding fathers and he's just standing up to authority. What happened was after the revolution, the militias were esteemed, but people like George Washington didn't actually think they did a very good job of fighting. The country, the new country, began to fall apart pretty quickly. There were all kinds of issues relating to military power. There was almost a coup d'etat when the army officers almost marched on Congress to demand their pay. And then you start to have mobs and armed resistance against the government. The most famous example of that was Shay's Rebellion out in western Massachusetts, where people didn't want to pay their debts and marched. And the militias were sent in to keep order, and they took a vote and switched sides. they couldn't really be relied on very well to keep the peace in the new country. So Shay's Rebellion was one of the things that prompted them to go and write the new constitution. The leading figures of the states went behind closed doors and created a constitution that they really felt was thrusting emphatically toward a stronger central government, and it one that, by the way, could have an army. They decided not to ban having an army. This was really something they debated internally a lot. When the Constitution got released to the public, it was this amazing event, this roaring debate over the Constitution and whether to ratify it. And one of the things that the opponents of the Constitution were worried about was that the new government would crush the 13 state militias with their citizen soldiers. And so as the Constitution moved from state to state and faced opposition, eventually there was the idea that states would ratify it, but that there could be some amendments afterwards. And states proposed dozens of amendments, many of them contradictory, kind of all different topics, all different kinds of stuff. And the Constitution finally got ratified. But even then, we came close to not having a Bill of Rights, Second Amendment, or any of the other parts of the Bill of Rights. you know, James Madison, as I think you know, wound up playing this interesting role as a recurring character throughout all of this. He was, as we would say nowadays, he was against the Bill of Rights before he was for it. to paraphrase John Kerry, he helped write the Constitution. He co-authored the Federalist Papers, saying it didn't need to be amended. Then he ran for Congress in the first election and was gerrymandered, before they even came up with that word, into a district that was against the Constitution. And to win, he had to sort of do a big, the first great flip-flop in American political history, and came out for a Bill of Rights and got to pass it. So in the first Congress, Madison proposed 20 amendments on topics ranging from the size of congressional districts to congressional pay to the things we now know as the Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment was actually the fifth of these amendments. And it's very striking when you look at what they were talking about. You know, we are all so engaged now, today, in these intense debates over guns, gun rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so we look at this debate and kind of are looking for where's that debate then. But if you look at Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention, or with scattered exceptions, the records of the ratification conventions, or emphatically the debate in the House of Representatives about the Second Amendment as they wrote it and marked it up, there's not a word about an individual right to gun ownership for personal protection or hunting or the things we talk about now. It's all about the militias. In fact, Madison's original proposal had a conscientious objector clause.
Yeah.
That's what they were debating. It's rather startling.
You bring up the point, though, that it didn't need to be formally in the Constitution because it was a matter of common knowledge that the right to bear arms to protect oneself was a part of English common law. So, of course,
right.
It would be a part of the early America.
Right. There were plenty of guns, and people believed they had a right to protect themselves, especially in their homes. And that was handed down from England, from English common law, which is, you know, judged from court cases. They didn't write all of English common law into the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But they expected to be able to have guns, but at the same time, and this is also somewhat surprising to a lot of contemporary Americans now, they had the right to protect themselves, and there were a lot of gun laws and gun control laws.
Mm-hmm.
In the city of Boston, it was illegal to have a loaded gun in your home. Philadelphia and lots of other cities limited where you could use guns in the city, or there were all kinds of gun registries. There were limits on who could own guns. Not all of them, you know, some of them were only loyal citizens. Tories couldn't have guns. Some of them were Catholics, couldn't have guns, things like that. Not things we would, you know, find a good thing now. But there was a whole web of gun laws that were at the same time. You had gun rights coexisting with gun laws, but they didn't think they were putting either of them, I don't think, in the Constitution.
Yeah, fascinating.
But this is the tradition that's grown up. That it's not like nobody had a gun. You know, I always say, just ask Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they had guns.
What's so fascinating about this is that we go ahead to the NRA and their lobby, which forgets completely about the well-regulated militia, so they're just quoting the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. You talk about the Heller case and the primary author of that, Scalia, who devotes out of pages and pages, only two pages, to the militia. Why have we forgotten, which is a big part of this Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state? Why do we forget that part?
Part of the reason we've forgotten it is that the militias began to fade away. We don't really have anything like that now. It's not really the same thing as the National Guard or the Army. It really, you know, it was more like a universal lifetime draft. And so the militias faded away. The original meaning at that point of the Second Amendment, the sort of political meaning as a bulwark against tyranny, that faded away too. And the country sort of grew and changed. We became more individualistic we moved west. And again, all through it, we had plenty of guns and we had gun laws. I like to point to the this wonderful photograph of Dodge City, the archetypal Wild West town, you know, and it looks like a movie set, the dusty main street, and it says, "Welcome to Dodge City, firearms prohibited," from the 1880s. And that's sort of how it grew. You had various points along the way based on what people thought of government, principally, mm-hmm. more willingness or less willingness to protect gun rights, but always kind of gun rights and strict gun controls going at the same time. And up until in 1991, the retired Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Warren Burger, who was a rock-ribbed conservative appointed by Richard Nixon, he said the idea that the Second Amendment recognizes an unlimited individual right to gun ownership was, as he put it, a fraud on the public. And what did change, and of course that feels like as ancient as the colonial times to us now. Mm-hmm. And what changed really was the role of gun rights advocates and the NRA especially waged a three-decade kind of classic campaign to change the way we saw the Constitution, to change how we read this provision. You're right that the NRA, you know, it's interesting. It's been around for a long time. It was formed after the Civil War to improve marksmanship by former Union officers, and it was very focused on training and preparedness, and then eventually spoke for sportsmen and hunters, but not particularly focused on gun control laws. In 1977, it was going to move its headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Colorado to signal a retreat from politics, hard to believe though that might be. And they had their annual meeting. It was called the Revolt at Cincinnati, and 1,000 activists showed up, voted out the old leadership, voted in new leadership that was much more dogmatic and intense and focused on this constitutional crusade and refashioning the NRA around that crusade. And as you said, when you go to the lobby of the NRA headquarters in Virginia right now, there on the wall in Pride of Place is the Second Amendment, but they've edited it. Right. They just edited out the first half. Yeah. And, you know, I had read this in magazine articles, and I thought, oh, this, as I was working on this book, on the Second Amendment, and I said, oh, this is great. You know, this is a real novelistic touch to have this. And then I thought, uh-oh, what if it's not true? You know, it is in the lobby of their building. Like, right. That one's pretty easy to disprove.
Right.
And that would kind of get the book off to a bad start.
Yeah, it would have.
So my close colleague and assistant, Poi Winnechuckle, who is a brilliant young woman from Madison, who was working with me on the book, went down to Fairfax on a reconnaissance mission and went to the gift shop at the headquarters. And while she was there, took a photo of the wall to show that, yes, it does, in fact, still have the edited Second Amendment, but also bought some T-shirts and hats, you know, to justify her being there. So we have, so she did a lot of research and writing on the book, but had played that important role of taking the visit to the gift shop.
Well, I hope that soon your book will be sold in that gift shop. What do you think, Michael? That would be nice.
You know, could be.
Yeah, it could be. Let's go to the Civil War for a moment, which was, you write about this too, and I found a lot of this fascinating and new information. There were a lot of people who were probably madder than they had been in a heck of a long time. You had the element of race. You had a lot of guns around. You had John Brown. You had a fascinating story about Beecher's Bible. Yeah. Considering the element of race here, and I want to ask you about the 14th Amendment in a moment, because a lot of people use that to justify policies today. Were there attempts, because people were afraid of African-Americans having guns, because people in the North didn't want the South, you know, there were guns everywhere, and yet brothers were using them against brothers, and you had access, perhaps, from people who had been slaves. Were there any attempts during that horrible time in history to limit guns in this country? How did we deal with guns then?
Well, it was a horrible time, but also fascinating to learn about and surprising, too. You're right that the Civil War, you know, before there was the Civil War, there was Bleeding Kansas, as it was known, where pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces battled with what were called Beecher's Bibles, which was the minister, Henry Ward Beecher, said there is more moral power in a Sharp's rifle than in a crate load of Bibles.
Ooh-wee.
And so you know, there were obviously huge amounts of violence and guns and terrible loss of life during the Civil War. What people don't quite realize is that a kind of low-grade guerrilla war between the races continued after the Civil War was over in the South. And the Southern states passed laws to disarm only black people.
Hmm.
And there were hundreds of thousands of freedmen, former slaves, many of them had served in the Union Army, who were back in the South, who were now being terrorized by white vigilantes, the Ku Klux Klan and others. And one of the purposes of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was to make sure those African Americans could get guns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not entirely clear. I think some people think it's clearer than I do that that this converted the militia right into an individual right, because there was still a lot of militias in those days. But it definitely was more. There were definitely a number of the framers of the 14th Amendment who felt that what they were doing was recognizing the individual right of African Americans to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And even so, and this goes back to the kind of twin we had between gun rights and gun control, even so, those military governments in the South had very strict restrictions on guns,
mm-hmm.
On carrying weapons and things like that. And then in part of the shame of what happened with Reconstruction, even some of those rights were taken away from African Americans, and gun ownership really became more of a white privilege in the South as it had been before the Civil War.
We're going to welcome phone calls. There's so much to talk about because of the very elaborate and well-researched history of this issue, and it takes into account wars and wars, the North against the South, and race in this country, and militias, and we're covering this huge period of time from revolutionary time until now. Each time period, looking at the Second Amendment in a different way, but not seeing it as an individual right to have a gun until 2008, many, many years after the Constitution. The book is The Second Amendment, a biography. Michael Waldman is the author of this extremely informative book. Michael is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. Here's our phone number and beyond email, too. Our phone is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow on our program, first hour of the program, we'll be talking about the incredible mess in Iraq. What were we fighting for? Was this inevitable? Is ISIS a threat to the United States? How are they getting their money? We'll talk about that. Hour two of the show tomorrow, as you well know, we're marking the 100th anniversary of World War I. It started 100 years ago over the weekend, so we will be speaking about World War I and all of the issues that still resonate 100 years later. All right, Michael Waldman is our guest. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in, and we have so much to talk about. John in Wanakee. Hi, John.
Hey, guys. Just an observation or two. I'm a lawyer and happen to be interested in constitutional stuff like this. Also have been a hunter and around guns for all my life. And so I hang out with a lot of the hook and bullet guys who have this unbelievable interest in the Constitution when it comes to this issue. And, you know, you may be right in that the Constitution didn't envision an individual right. I don't think there'll ever be consensus on that. And when you take that issue and say, okay, let's say we can't figure that out for certainty, let's amend the Constitution. Let's enshrine the individual right in the Constitution and then subject it to reasonable restrictions. You know, the right to bear arms shall be individual, subject to reasonable governmental restrictions. Fourth Amendment has done that. Courts have developed what reasonable restrictions are. It's played out that way and in politics as well. But it seems like trying to say definitively this is what it meant back then, even were you correct, a Breyer might say, yeah, well, but that's with muskets, not with Tech 9, so we need to adapt it anyways. So I believe the solution to this is a political solution, not a court-driven constitutional analysis. That's just my observation.
What's the political solution?
Having the states vote on the nature of an amendment to the Second Amendment.
Okay.
Which is to enshrine individual right, which will make the NRA and the hook and bullet guys ecstatic, right? But to also say subject to reasonable restrictions, something
okay.
like the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, gotcha. Michael.
I think there's a lot of meat and validity to what the caller says. I mean, in this, first off, I do think that this whole issue is best dealt with in the legislature and the democratically accountable branches. There are all kinds of dangers that happen when something like this gets pulled into courts, where judges are not necessarily best equipped to do the kind of compromises or weigh the various factors. What the caller describes, in a sense, is what the Supreme Court ultimately did, or especially how it's been interpreted. So in the 2008 case of District of Columbia versus Heller, it said it was looking at the original intent, and Justice Antonin Scalia, who wrote it, was very proud. He said that this, to him, reflected his philosophy of originalism, that you need to go back and look at what they meant in 1791 mm-hmm. to understand any constitutional provision. But then, if you sort of strip away all the finery of originalism, what the Supreme Court said is actually not that different from what the caller said, which is it's an individual right, but there can be restrictions, just as there are on other constitutional rights. And interestingly, the Supreme Court didn't say really how far the right extended or what those restrictions were. There have been dozens and dozens of court cases all over the country since 2008. And overwhelmingly, that's what they've concluded. They've actually upheld existing gun laws, saying, yes, there's an individual right, but the society also has a right to protect itself, or there's a compelling government interest in strong gun laws, and they're not incompatible. And so it sort of has played out that way. And I don't know that I would – I think I wouldn't feel it necessary to amend the Constitution if in fact, it continues to play out that you can have both gun rights and strong gun laws. We don't know, of course, for sure how it's going to ultimately end up because the Supreme Court hasn't spoken again.
And yeah, when you say the restrictions that were going ahead with those in the state, you don't have to look any farther than what happened after Newtown, I believe, and you cite this really interesting exchange between Ted Cruz and Dianne Feinstein talking about reissuing a ban on assault weapons and looking at certain kinds of weapons and whether or not we need them. And, you know, nothing happened from that. We didn't reinstate this ban on assault weapons. Why didn't we do this? Why did the Ted Cruz side apparently win?
Well, in a few states, in New York and in Colorado and in Connecticut and a few other places, they actually did pass new laws restricting or banning assault weapons. Interestingly, in the Congress, the main bill that was discussed, which had up to 90% of the public support in the polls, was to expand and strengthen background checks.
Mm-hmm.
for buying guns so
mm-hmm.
that only, you know, criminals or other people who shouldn't have guns shouldn't get guns. That had massive public support. It did not lose. It was called the Manchin-Toomey bill. It was a bipartisan bill. It didn't lose because people thought that it violated the Second Amendment. It lost because it was filibustered. It actually had a majority of the Senate. And so, interestingly, ultimately, the Second Amendment didn't play on that one such a strong role, but I do agree that if the kinds of things that are to ban a certain category of weapons, people get very, very worried that that's going to lead to confiscation
right.
of all their guns.
Yeah.
And it is those assault weapons are the fastest, the AR-15s and others, are the fastest growing category of mm-hmm. guns being bought in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to what I think is a neglected time in history. And this book is, I love it because it is so thorough. You look at what led up to this incredible NRA convention where they got rid of the leadership and really took a step to the right and became a whole different organization in 1977, preceded by a decade of assassinations of a president and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald getting his weapon through a mail order catalog. But all of the, you talk about the cultural things that were happening in this country and people being aligned, the anti-gun people being aligned with communists and probably, you know, free lovers or whatever. That being perhaps the basis, or is this an overstatement for the NRA purging their leadership and taking a turn to the right?
I think it's very tied up with that. And, of course, you mentioned Lee Harvey Oswald. It's just a fascinating footnote. He bought his gun through the NRA's magazine.
Amazing.
The American Rifleman.
Yeah.
Through a clip, through a pseudonym, clipping an ad. You know, we all think of the 1960s, of course, as having been this time of great social change and of having, you know, having made all these changes in society and of course, that was true, but in a lot of respects, it was the reaction to the 1960s in the 70s and thereafter that shaped the political environment we live in for decades to come. The 60s was a time of riots, of rising crime, as well as assassinations and massive social turmoil. And there was a backlash to that and a move to the right among a lot of kind of very mainstream traditional American institutions. The NRA was one of them, but the evangelical churches, the farm groups, the tax revolt that began in California in 1979. You had what was called the Sagebrush Rebellion against the Interior Department's environmental policies at the same time as you had this revolt in Cincinnati. They all sounded like a bunch of revolutionaries. And it became a sort of the beginnings of a libertarian revolt against government. And it turned out that people's attitude toward government had a lot to do with all these things, but including their attitude toward guns and gun laws. And so the turn to the right at the NRA helped fuse a new political coalition. The very first candidate for president that the NRA ever supported was Ronald Reagan in 1980. The 1972 Republican platform had actually backed stronger gun control. But by 1980, you know, the kind of conservative coalition with which we're familiar today had begun really in a strong way to take shape. And, of course, that has helped shape the politics of the last three decades.
Interesting. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. This hour we're talking about that Second Amendment, and the author of The Second Amendment, a biography, Michael Waldman, is our guest. Michael, after Newtown, his response was to do a history, and a thorough history it is, of the Second Amendment. He is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Jeffrey in Duluth is our next caller. Hi, Jeffrey.
Yeah, it's Jerry, but that's okay.
I'm sorry. Hi, Jerry.
That's okay. Hey, I was wondering if Michael read about the riot that happened in Athens, Tennessee in 1946, where the citizenry took up arms against an election where the mayor and the ballots that was going on with him were throwing the election, and the citizenry took up arms and stormed the jail to take the ballots back. That would be a clear use of a citizenry militia taking up arms to go against the National Guard and the sheriffs and the police in the town. How would you explain that?
But it's another interesting moment in history. I don't write about it in the book. I'm not that familiar with it. It is the kind of thing that they grappled with in the founding era. You know, the value of an armed citizenry as a fight against political tyranny. What they came to believe, in a way, this goes back, that was kind of like Shay's Rebellion. What the framers, George Washington and Madison and the others, came to believe pretty strongly was that the militias needed to be governmental, state government institutions, and that it wasn't up to every citizen to say, okay, now I'm in a militia, and if I don't like something the government's going to do, I'm going to form a military force and take it into my own hand. It was an interesting change in their thinking way back then, because while the Second Amendment was in the process of being ratified by the states, they had another rebellion called the Whiskey Rebellion, where people in western Pennsylvania didn't want to pay a whiskey tax. And they said, you know, we're just carrying out our rights here. And George Washington led the militia against them of the government and said, no, from now on, we're the militia. And so this question of, you know, is this the government or is mm-hmm. this an individual right, was the kind of thing people wrestled with and grappled with. Personally, I don't think that we want to live in a country where everybody takes matters into their own hands. That would signal to me a real breakdown in democracy and the rule of law. And so, you know, that's one of the things we wrestle with, is I don't think that we really want to see, be a trigger, hair's trigger away from armed rebellion at all moments.
Michael Waldman, our guest. The book is The Second Amendment, A Biography. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, the author of The Second Amendment, A Biography, Joseph Ellis, founder of Founding Brothers, has said Waldman's new book will not make the most zealous NRA advocates happy, but for anyone who wants his or her history of the Second Amendment straight up, this is the most comprehensive, accessible, and compelling version of the story in print. High praise, and I think it's very true. It really is a compelling story and a fascinating story. Before we go back to the phone calls later in the book, Michael, you talk about where we are now. You talk about the number of guns, 270 million civilian firearms, three times as many as per person as Canada and 15 times as many as England. But the rank of gun owners, you say, has not swelled. In fact, they've dropped sharply. And gun violence, although it's certainly not true in certain neighborhoods in Milwaukee, for instance, or other cities, gun violence is down. Put that into some kind of context. Why are the numbers down and fewer people are owning lots of guns?
Right. Fewer people are owning more and more guns. You know, if you think about it, the reason people own guns has shrunk somewhat. There are fewer hunters, fewer people living in rural areas. Land development has encroached on the places where people used to hunt. There are fewer and fewer people who have the history or tradition of being in the military. You know, when you think of how many people served in World War II or you know, Vietnam, it's a much smaller military force now. So the base of gun ownership is shrinking. But also, as you said, gun crime is going down across the country. Maybe, you know, not in some places. Chicago continues to have terrible problems, maybe Milwaukee, but the numbers are going down. And what that suggests is there are ways of solving some of the problems of violence. Of course, these school shootings and deranged mass killings grab our attention.
Oh, yeah.
But the daily violence that too many people are subject to is dropping. And that, to me, potentially offers some hope, which is there are common sense solutions, common sense rules, technological fixes that could make a big difference and are being developed in various places. I was very struck by a recent statistic that I learned after the book was done. This year, for the first time, more people in the United States will be killed by firearms than by cars.
Oh, my.
33,000 people. Now, at one level, that's a terrifying and terrible
yes.
statistic. And now, a lot of that is suicide. But, you know, still, that's much, much higher than in other countries. On the other hand, what's really striking is that the number of people killed by cars has gone down so much.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that? Why is the death rate from cars gone down? Well, you know, they didn't ban cars. They didn't confiscate them or take away your right to drive. They made cars safer.
Mm-hmm.
Airbags. They put in airbags and seat belts, and they raised the drinking age and lowered the speed limit and all the other technological ways we've made cars less lethal. And there are things like that that can make guns less likely to be used by the wrong people, less likely to be used by children, you know, accidentally, or people who shouldn't have guns. And what I worry about is that sort of Second Amendment fundamentalism, this idea that any restriction of gun ownership or use at all flies in the face of our sacred individual rights, and that you should be able to go to court to get that right upheld, could really stand in the way of a lot of the kinds of innovation that I think could make a difference.
Could make people safer, yeah.
Technology and trigger locks and smart guns and other things.
Mm-hmm. Like. Jeff in Ashland, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I turned in late, and I don't know what you people have covered. I am a firearm owner. I've been shooting for better than 50 years, and I am definitely for the Second Amendment, but there has to be some rationale as far as legislation goes. I was at the NRA convention about 6 weeks ago, and my God, you can buy 250 round magazines for guns. Now, I can't see any justification in the world for that to be legal. And once again, I'm not looking to have the government regulate my anything, but at some point, enough is enough. And I just cannot begin to understand how anybody can oppose that kind of legislation.
Mm. Michael.
Yeah, no, I think the caller makes a very strong point. And it's interesting, you know, again, I think that there's millions and millions of gun owners, of hunters, of people who have guns for all different kinds of reasons who feel the same way as the caller does. You know, the challenge is the intensity of some folks who really do feel that limiting 250 round magazine or something like that would be trampling on their constitutional rights. But as the Supreme Court said, and as I do think the history of the whole Second Amendment going back 200 plus years suggests, you know, all rights require responsibilities too. That's true for all the rights we have in the Constitution. And so, you know, there ought to be a way to protect legitimate gun ownership, but also deal with some of the most dangerous manifestations of it.
You say in the book, and I wanted to ask you to draw this out a little bit for us, to the extent that historical analogies will need to be drawn to obscure gun policies of the early republic, pro-regulation advocates are about two decades behind. They have just begun to catalog early American gun laws, a vital step to show that tradition allowed reasonable regulation. They've just begun to catalog this? Are you serious? Why? What?
Well, it's true that the gun rights folks, the NRA, were working this on this constitutional and historical basis long before their other side, because the law had previously been so clear and so uncontested.
Mm.
You know, the NRA, when they did this long-term campaign, and they actually started with scholarship, some of it good, a lot of it, I suggest, very flimsy, about what was really meant in the old days and what their understanding were of the rights. It's only in the last decade or so that historians have really spent a lot of time, as you say, culling and talking about the web of gun laws that in fact did exist, or the early cases where state Supreme Courts in the 1830s and 40s and 50s said, no, this is not an individual right, this is about the militias, you know, and things like that.
Right.
You know, a lot of this goes to the question of how we really ought to be making these decisions. I'm not a fan of this doctrine known as originalism.
Mm-hmm.
Which
I
is
can tell.
Of course, it's a history book.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of history. And, you know, one can imagine that I'm saying, well, maybe that history ought to be the sole way we decide. But, you know, I don't think we really as a country should be trying to govern ourselves based on trying to figure out what they meant in 1791 alone. That's important to know, but so too is how we've evolved as a country, what our needs are now, what the technology of an assault weapon is now versus a musket back then. You know, what does it mean now
mm-hmm.
to possess arms? It may mean having a drone. Everybody has the right to a drone. You know, is that really what James Madison meant? Is probably not the way we ought to make that decision. But because of the way the courts, a very conservative Supreme Court, have looked at it, you do get a lot of kind of amateur historical sleuthing.
Well, there's no doubt about it. If you brought James Madison back now, he would be flabbergasted, don't you think?
in many ways.
He sure would be. Let's go to Adriana in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. So I am a teacher. I have taught in both Chicago Public Schools and now in the Eau Claire School District. And I understand, I mean, guns freak me out, but I do understand how people want to use them for sports and guns and, you know, hunting and things like that. And, but I guess the guest is saying, you know, they're scared about Second Amendment fundamentalism. They're talking about protecting the right to own guns. But when does it, do people start worrying about the people who don't have guns? You know, like I said, I'm a teacher, and after all the school shootings, I start thinking, like, where am I going to hide if there is a shooting? If someone crazy walks in here, where would I take my children? How will I protect them? You know, how do I, you know, escape routes and things like that? And it's just sad that nobody's thinking so much about that, especially all those people who are talking about, you know, let's protect gun rights. How about the people who don't own guns and don't want to own guns?
Yeah, the fact that you even have to think about that is just appalling. Where can I go to be safe? In the Newtown, from what I understand, Michael, the Newtown shooting prompted your study of all of this.
That's right. It was in the wake of that terrible tragedy with the awful killings and the heroism of the teachers and school officials there was why I wrote the book, to try to understand how our decisions now about what we can do to bring sanity to this are affected by and maybe limited by the way we think the Constitution talks about it. And I think the caller really speaks to something important. I think there is a, you know, most Americans don't own guns. And there may well be sort of a silent majority of people who feel threatened by the direction that things are going, who are fed up, who look at something like the open carry movement in Texas, where people, you know, the state of Georgia just passed a law called the Carry Everywhere Law, basically, where you can bring guns to church or to a park or a bar, and there's video of, you know, Little League players screaming in fear as someone showed up with an assault weapon, just saying he was just following his constitutional rights. And you have these videos of these guys in Texas running around into Chipotle restaurants or Target stores with assault weapons, and it's really been a backlash against that. It's actually hurt their efforts and hurt their movement, and I think especially for women, there's something very culturally off about the whole thing. I've been in Chicago recently, and because that was a place where a court struck down the existing gun laws, and the legislature just passed a new law that was much looser in terms of carrying guns, but businesses, places of business, can keep people with guns out, but they have to put a decal on the window. So everywhere you go now in the city of Chicago, there's a big gun with a red line through it at eye level as you walk into a business or an office, and it is, for a lot of people, very unnerving and not really the way they want to live.
Right.
So, you know, what I think people like the caller need to do is what the NRA and its allies did, which is to be relentless not, you know, wait for the next atrocity, but keep talking about it and change the public mind, because that's ultimately what leads to changes in laws.
And thank you very much, Adriana, for your call. I'm sorry, we just can't take any more phone calls. We're just plumb out of time. But, Michael, thank you so much for writing this book. I just think you've made it valuable. It's reasonable and it's historical, and we don't get the history of things like the Second Amendment very often. I really thank you for for your work. It's good.
Oh, well, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. Michael Waldman, our guest this hour. The book is The Second Amendment, a biography. Michael is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. He was director of speech writing for President Bill Clinton from 95 to 99. He's the author of My Fellow Americans, POTUS Speaks, and several other books. And the book is, I know I've been praising it, but I, you know, we do a lot of reading for the show, and it is good because it's this lengthy history, and there's so many factors woven in. So we're looking at the American Revolutionary times and the role of militias and the argument about militias and English common law, and we're going to the Civil War, and race becomes an issue, and we're going into World War II, and it. Each time we live in defines how we view the Second Amendment. And we're living in a completely different era now than ever before. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this very interesting show.